The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern, continuing the final farewell month of this program with more memorable segments of the last 32 and a half years. First, inside Watergate, 40 years since the Nixon resignation, we revisit the views of Washington Post reporters Woodward and Bernstein and the late publisher Kay Graham. Then Beyond the Cold War, master espionage novelist John le Carré on changes in Russia, in the work of real spies, and the challenge for writers like himself. Next, a Reagan rebuttal, Nancy Reagan on her memoir with a title that implied correcting the record, My Turn, and Life After the White House. Followed by a Frank memorial, Sinatra's daughter Tina, American songbook historian Wilfred Sheed, and cabaret queen Andrea Markovici on the magic of old blue eyes. Finally, Shame in the Church, Fame in the Camera, a key report on child abuse by priests, and photographer Richard Avedon on art and exploitation, plus key quotes from last week's news. For Your Ears Only, for the week of September 21st, 2014, I'm David Alpern with a quote from last week's news. We were all out of touch, and now we're paying for it. That was a former British government official on the surprising strength of nationalist sentiment in Scotland, though a referendum on resigning from the United Kingdom was rejected by a wider margin than polls predicted, 54-46%, based in part on London's promise of more regional authority. Spain's government threatened to block an independence vote in the Catalan region. Now, this insider view of the Nixon resignation 40 years ago from our June 6, 2005 Newsweek On Air show after FBI official Mark Felt was revealed as the Watergate source called Deep Throat, co-hosted by Ginger Otis and Warren Levinson of Associated Press.
You can't have the guy that's running it going around giving out secret information. It's one thing for somebody in government to leak things, that's fine, but not the deputy director of the FBI.
This was always Nixon's worst fear, that the FBI didn't like him and they would go out to nail him. And this was one of the reasons he was motivated to cover up. Well, he might have been right.
There's nothing heroic about breaking faith with your people, breaking the law, sneaking around in garages.
Like many former Nixon aides, Charles Colson, John Dean, and Pat Buchanan had harsh views of Mark Felt. As Deep Throat, he brought their leader to shame and resignation, and in the case of some, like Colson and Dean, there were prison sentences in a painful resolution of Watergate. But try as they might to shift the blame for the nation's premier political scandal to its best-known anonymous source, the facts that some of us remember covering are hard to dispute. A paranoid president in a White House steeped in secret tactics and such a powerful presumption it was above the law or capable of corrupting it that it taped itself in the process.
Reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein were not always as close as they were during the Watergate days of the early 1970s or as they are today. But Newsweek On Air brought them together in 1989 to discuss the legacy of Watergate and the impact of a new TV version of their second book about it, The Final Days. And on the 20th anniversary of the break-in, we got the perspective of the late Katharine Graham, legendary boss lady of the Washington Post Company, which also owns Newsweek.
We started by asking Woodward his reaction to the TV reenactment.
Happily, in making the movie, they stuck to the facts, and the facts establish the crimes, and the crimes are dealt with, particularly through the tapes, which kind of become a Greek chorus in the movie, and you see what he said, and you see what he did, and I think it makes it vividly clear that he resigned because he realized he was guilty.
Let's turn to Carl Bernstein for a second. Have your own views of the Watergate crimes changed as we've all gone through Koreagate and WedTechGate and Irangate and the rest? If all of what happened to Nixon, if all of these later scandals had happened first, do you think Nixon would have had to pay the price he did for Watergate?
I think what Richard Nixon did was unprecedented, and it was extraordinary, and you have to keep in mind that what he did was totally go against the oath of office he had taken to uphold the Constitution, and that we'd never had anything like that happen in our history before. And I think that this TV movie makes it clear the enormity of what he did in this regard. At the same time, and I think that indeed would it happen again today, that probably the same result would happen, that he would have to leave office. What the movie does, as the book does, is that it shows an empathic view of the man's human situation. Here's the first man in our history trapped by his own acts and reacting to being closed in on. And it's at moments, it's very sad and compelling, just as it was in the book that we wrote.
Woodward and Bernstein on this show on October 22, 1989. In June of 1992, to mark the 20th anniversary of Watergate, co-host Warren Levinson and I spoke with the legendary Washington Post head lady Katharine Graham about trusting her reporters and their anonymous source through the crunch and about the scandal's legacy on journalism.
In general, when you have a story that is very exciting, it's exclusive for about 5 minutes, and then everybody piles on and it's not exclusive anymore. And with Watergate, it was exclusive for June to more or less the end of the summer. I don't mean totally exclusive either, because thank heaven there were a few other publications, the Los Angeles Times and Time, and I can't remember, but there were moments when people came in, which were of great comfort. And finally, in October, Walter Cronkite did 2 10-minute pieces on the air, and that was a great help because it took us national. So what made the pressure of being alone on it great was that you thought, if this is such a wonderful story, where is everybody else?
Carl Bernstein has talked about being concerned about his personal safety at one point, and I gather you were warned by some friends not to be alone, physically, literally. Can you recall those feelings?
Yeah, I didn't take that too seriously, to be honest. What I did take seriously was the threats made against the company. And those were threats against our television station licenses that made our stock plummet. And then there were other threats. They cut off access to everybody in the White House. They wouldn't answer our phones. They wouldn't let anybody come over here to editorial lunches. They wouldn't let anybody come to my house to dinner, which was not exactly the worst threat in the world. but it was sort of total.
You've said any number of times that it wasn't the Washington Post and it wasn't journalism that brought Richard Nixon down. What was the role of the press, do you think?
Well, I think it was its proper role. The role of the press was to keep the story alive when they were trying to hush it up. The thing that brought the president down was proper constitutional procedures, which was the courts and the grand juries and finally the committees of Congress.
10 years ago, a Newsweek poll found the majority of Americans thinking that Watergate could happen again, and some people today believe it has, perhaps even worse, in the Iran-Contra case. How do you see that?
Well, I don't see Iran-Contra as quite in the league with Watergate, because I really think that what was at stake in Watergate was an attempt to pervert the democratic system. I think that, in a sense, Iran-Contra was very serious because it was going around the mandate of Congress, and it was bad. But I don't think it was a perversion of the total system or an attempt to, which is what happened at the time of Watergate.
What do you think is the long-term enduring legacy of Watergate for the press?
I think that it is the role of investigative reporting clearly became more important, but I think that it was overdone for a while. I mean, I think everybody in the world, all the young people in the world, went to journalism school and wanted to investigate everything, and I think they overdid it. I think you have to investigate things. You have to be skeptical, but you shouldn't be vengeful, and you have to be fair, and you have to be careful.
The late Katharine Graham on Watergate's 20th anniversary from our June 14th, 1992 broadcast, and before that, reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein.
From our June 6, 2005 Newsweek on Air program. Now, this quote from last week's news: there's plenty of great reporting going on. The question is it going to be supported by readers and viewers? That was Carl Bernstein at a joint appearance with Woodward in Ohio, decrying the loss of interest in serious news and meaningful reaction to it. Woodward earlier faulted President Obama for alienating too many Democrats in the House and Senate by not listening to them. Indeed, Obama last week lost a significant number of Democratic votes for what many felt was an ill-conceived plan to fight the brutal Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, though he also picked up unaccustomed support from some predictably hawkish Republicans. Next, Le Carré on Le Cold War and challenges left by its ending, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm David Alpern with another quote from last week's news. That's when the rubber is going to meet the road. That was a senior Defense Department official on the extreme difficulty of forcing ISIS out of Iraqi cities, where air and artillery bombardment hold a high risk of civilian casualties that could also reinforce ISIS' appeal. Despite repeated promises by President Obama not to send in U.S. combat troops, the Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman testified they may be necessary. Now, a best segment from our May 28, 1989 Newsweek On Air show with co-host Warren Levinson of AP.
Opening theme music from the movie version of The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, a 1960s novel that introduced the world to author John le Carré, instantly acclaimed as a master of Cold War espionage and Cold War contradictions, patriotic double crosses, ambiguous loyalties, divided souls.
There followed a string of le Carré bestsellers, including Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, The Honorable Schoolboy, Smiley's People, The Little Drummer Girl, and more autobiographical, The Perfect Spy.
This week, the latest le Carré hits the bookstalls with a difference. The Russia House is his first novel of espionage in the era of Glasnost, when new stirrings of freedom and dissent inside the Soviet system mean new levels of unpredictability on both sides of the Iron Curtain. It is also the first book le Carré has been able to research by actually visiting the Soviet Union.
From Russia with Love, it might have been called, if that title hadn't already been taken. John le Carré is the subject of this week's cover story in Newsweek. To talk about the Russia House, Glasnost, espionage, and himself, we're pleased to have John le Carré, real name David Cornwell. Welcome to Newsweek On Air. I was surprised to learn that you hadn't been to Russia before, though it's understandable given your admissions to Newsweek and others that you had actually worked in British intelligence under Foreign Service cover. What made you decide to go after all these years?
Well, I thought it was time, in the most simple historical sense. I was quite certain that to be in Russia at the moment was to be present at an extraordinary period of our history. It was going to be as exciting as, so to speak, as standing in Berlin and watching the Reichstag burn, only this time the Reichstag was being restored and things were looking more positive.
Was their decision to let you in itself a sign of glasnost?
I think it was. It wasn't easily made. I applied first to the Soviet embassy in London and received no answer at all to my letter to the cultural attaché. And then I went through the ambassador, our ambassador in Moscow, and all of a sudden the walls came down and I got an invitation from the Union of Writers.
How did the Russia you saw compare with the Russia you've written about in such dark detail for so many years?
Well, perceived from outside during the Cold War, the Soviet Union looked like a dark castle, and I think I described it that way. And I described, indeed, both camps as groaning under the weight of the Cold War and the misery of ideological complexity and, on the Soviet side, enslavement to a system that wasn't working. Most particularly, I suppose, I thought of the Soviet Union as monolithic, as a centrally organized outfit, because of its repressive capacities and its repressive effect upon its population. By the time I got there, it was so clearly disintegrating that that monolith could no longer be found.
You were offered the chance to meet British traitor Kim Philby, a rough model for some of the Soviet moles in your fictional British Secret Services, but you refused. Why?
Well, I felt it inelegant to be the guest of the ambassador one night, that is, of the Queen's representative, and the guest of the Queen's biggest traitor the next night. And so if it was an invitation to meet Kim Philby, I was quite pleased to pass it up. I also don't think that I could have sat with Philby indefinitely without losing my temper. One does have to remember that he was a killer. He was, by my perception at least, a man of natural and persistent deceit. I thought he was a hateful man, always.
The Russia House will be published in the Soviet Union, but others of your books have not. Though I understand you have quite a following among, an underground following among the computer set.
Yes,
what do you know about that?
Yes, that was very touching when I got there to discover that students, for example, at the State University had apparently run up my books in English on a word processor and stood round it in groups and watched the pages being turned. So I was very moved by that.
It's computer samizdat.
That's right, computer samizdat, exactly.
What is there about espionage that makes it such an effective and affecting setting for serious contemporary novels such as yours?
Well, it's all around us. That's the first thing. I think all of us know that to a great extent, the version we are given of political events is not the reality. When all of a sudden we get a scandal like Irangate, we have held up to us to inspect the other perhaps nine-tenths of political life. So espionage enables us to interpret our perceptions in terms of conspiracy. That's one thing. But I think beyond that, the condition of a spy is one in which, to some extent, we all live, whether in relations to the institutions we work for, the firms, the corporations we work for, within marriage, outside marriage. All of us have secret lives that we're aware of. We often think we're the only people who live them, but in fact, most of us, to one extent or another, share those secret lives. And so perhaps the universality of my stuff in some way speaks to the unexpressed part of us.
I wonder if what we've been exposed to in real-life spying over the last few years, attempts on Fidel Castro's life, etc., make it harder or easier to write spy fiction.
I think that certainly in my case, it was always necessary to pull back from the reality in order to make one's stories credible. I mean, if you take, for example, the Watergate affair, if I'd set out to write a story about a president who bugged himself by mistake, I would have been ridiculed. And so it goes in the espionage business. If I'd written a story about flying cakes to Tehran, really people would have said Le Carré's lost his marbles. So I really have to find a much more modest context for my stuff.
Do you think that glasnost and a new era of good feeling, to the extent that they last, will make it harder for the East-West spy novel and the real-life self-serving intelligence bureaucracies of both sides?
I think the fun will be for those who write in the genre to break the pieces up, to listen and watch history in the making, and to readjust to whatever comes along in the future. I think what one must bear in mind is that the prospect of peace breaking out in no way suggests that espionage will be run down as an industry. Quite the reverse. If your former enemy is breaking into pieces and you don't know which way the pieces are going to jump, you must spy the living daylights out of him. What I do know is that I'm thrilled to face the future of perestroika and look for other theaters and other political situations to write about. I'm very glad to be given a whole new deck of cards.
I must say, the only thing better than reading your books is hearing you read them. I gather you just won one of the books that you've read on tape has just won a prize for that, and I don't think anybody does your work and all of the voices as well as you do.
Well, thank you very much. I can do bird noises too, but I won't do them now.
David Cornwell, better known as John Le Carré, author of The Russia House, just going on sale, and the subject of this week's cover story in Newsweek. Thanks again. Forget we ever talked.
From our May 28, 1989 Newsweek on Air program, now a quote on the new face of war from last week's news. "We will never obey or bend to the aggressor." That was Ukraine's President Pyotr Poroshenko seeking additional support from a joint session of the U.S. Congress to counter continued Russian subversion and incursion in border areas controlled by pro-Moscow separatists, even as the West escalated economic sanctions. Next, a Reagan rebuttal. Nancy's for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern with this quote from last week's news. "A level of international action unprecedented for a health emergency." That was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on the effort needed to halt Ebola that has now infected nearly 5,000 and killed more than 2,600 in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, where a three-day home confinement was ordered to locate and isolate others infected. Also last week, President Obama pledged medical aid and up to 3,000 troops to help control the epidemic. Now, this segment from our October 15th, 1989 Newsweek on Air broadcast, again with co-host Warren Levinson of AP.
"You've given us such a wonderful life, a life that I really never dreamed possible. And it's the most extraordinary feeling to represent a nation and its people. And I can never thank you enough for all the experiences and memories that you've made possible."
Nancy Reagan at the Republican convention in New Orleans last year. But that was hardly the whole story.
For 8 years, it seems, Mrs. Reagan was stunned and angered by misunderstandings and criticism that swirled around her as First Lady, from White House redecoration to borrowed frocks and from policy to astrology. But while few Americans thought of her as long-suffering, Mrs. Reagan felt she was holding her tongue. No more.
Her far more candid critical view of the Reagan years, key people and events, is revealed in her new book, My Turn, to be published shortly by Random House. And Newsweek's cover story this week is the first exclusive excerpt of that book, written with William Novak. He's the friendly ghost who worked early on the Lee Iacocca and Tip O'Neill autobiographies and one by Manhattan's Mayflower Madam.
My Turn discloses Mrs. Reagan's backstage role in several key situations, from suggesting President Reagan's first fireside chat with Mikhail Gorbachev to urging the dismissal of White House Chief of Staff Donald Regan, the man who told the world about the First Lady's astrologer. Of her own advice to her husband, she writes that she makes no apologies for telling him what she thought. For 8 years, she says, I was sleeping with the president, and if that doesn't give you special access, I don't know what does. I gave Ronnie my best advice whenever he asked for it, and sometimes when he didn't. But that doesn't mean he took it. Ronald Reagan has a mind of his own. As for President Reagan himself, Nancy calls him an inveterate optimist. Frankly, she says, it sometimes made me angry that Ronnie didn't get angry more often, especially at some of his advisors who let him down. There were times when his optimism led to problems and when a more suspicious person might have asked important and tough questions.
On the eve of My Turn's publication and shortly before leaving on a controversial speaking tour in Asia, Nancy Reagan talked with us about her new book. Here's that conversation. What impact do you hope your book will have on those who read it now or on their understanding of you as a person?
Well, I hope they understand me better as a person, which was the whole reason for writing it. Because during the 8 years, I never said anything about things that were said about me, and I hope this straightens out a lot of things that I didn't feel that I could say at the time.
What was the most difficult part of writing the book for you?
Oh, finally getting yourself to say things that you had held in for quite a long time, and Bill Novak had to tug a little bit from time to time.
You write in the introduction about holding your tongue on so many scores during the White House years, and the book is titled My Turn. Are you afraid some readers may read it, though, as getting even?
Oh, I hope not. I hope not, because I'd never intended it that way. Never. And I hope it doesn't come out that way. I hope it doesn't read that way. I tried very hard not to be vindictive, but there's a fine line you have to walk when you're writing a book like this. You try, on the one hand, that it not be self-serving, and on the other hand, that it not be vindictive. And all you want to do is just set the record straight about a lot of things that had been not straight.
You talk candidly about some of the problems you and President Reagan had had with your children over the years, the misunderstandings and especially distortions that come with the intensive media coverage. So I wonder if you've made sure that all your children had a chance to read the book first so that there are no surprises for them at least.
Well, first let me say, you know, every family has problems. Every family has problems. But to try to solve them when they're on the front pages of the papers every day, then it's very difficult to solve them without there being a lot of misunderstandings and a lot of hurt feelings that could have been avoided. The children have not read the chapters, although I have told them what's in the chapters. As a matter of fact, my son, Ron, told me that I had to go a little bit farther with him than I had gone, which I did.
You write at length about the astrology controversy that kicked up in the late years in the White House, but you never actually say whether you still consult Joan Quigley or another astrologer. Do you?
No, I haven't. I think I said in the book that at the end it was just really a matter of habit more than anything else.
To go back to the family issue, do you think that reading your view of your lives as a family and in the White House may, in a way, help improve relations among all the members of the Reagan clan?
Oh, our relations with Mike, Maureen, and Ron are great. I mean, There's no problem at all. None at all.
And the final question is, what's the best part about being out of the White House at last, and what's the worst part?
Best part is not being under the microscope as much as you are in the White House. Worst part is you miss the support system that you obviously have in the White House. And as I've said many times, you miss... When you need a plumber, you can always get a plumber in the White House.
Nancy Reagan, former First Lady of California of the United States and now author of a memoir called My Turn. David, you edited that excerpt for Newsweek. What did you think of the book?
I think it's fascinating the way Mrs. Reagan just failed to mention her daughter, Patty, the child with whom she admits she's had most trouble. But as she just told us, really opening up isn't easy for her. Among the biggest complaints of her White House years are all those detailed TV drawings and reports on various first family medical problems. At one point, she sort of joked to the president they could exchange framed drawings of their cancer operations. I think many readers will find the Nancy revealed in this book more human and understandable than before, but I suspect that her critics will find sufficient evidence of pettiness, distortion, and manipulation, some spite as well.
We've been talking about My Turn, the memoirs of Nancy Reagan, the first excerpts of which are in Newsweek this week.
From our October 15th, 1989 broadcast, now this quote from last week's news. More interested in singing Kumbaya with the manufacturers than being a cop on the beat. That was Senator Claire McCaskill on failures by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to act on evidence of the fatal failure in GM auto ignition switches detailed by a House committee report earlier in the week. Next, a Frank memorial. Sinatra, that is. For your ears only. Another chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern with this quote from last week's news. If he didn't have the right political clout, he would have been crushed already. That was Peking University professor Paul Gillis on Chinese government support for Jack Ma, whose multifunction internet giant Alibaba scored the largest initial public offering ever on the U.S. stock market, $22 billion, boosting its overall market value to $168 billion. Also last week, Home Depot confirmed the biggest data breach in retail history, 56 million customer credit card accounts with $3 billion in possible losses. Now a May 17, 1998 Newsweek on-air segment with AP's Warren Levinson again as co-host.
When they begin, the beginning, it brings back the sound of music so tender. It brings back a night of tropical splendor. It brings back a memory evergreen.
For Francis Albert Sinatra, Frank, Old Blue Eyes, and chairman of the board, the Beguine began back in Hoboken, New Jersey, and carried him through good times and bad, from the early stage shows and radio broadcasts, such as the one we just heard, through hi-fi, Hollywood, hobnobbing with presidents, losing and regaining his voice, and singing duets with an ever-younger generation of stars who revered him as a master of popular culture and stylish celebrity. It ended last week after 82 years with a heart attack and Sinatra's reported refusal of extraordinary life support, leaving a vast legacy of music, movies, and memories for everyone who ever loved or lost with his songs as soundtrack.
As he turned 80 back in 1995, we turned to author Wilfred Sheed, who won a Grammy for Sinatra liner notes, and to cabaret singer Andrea Markovici for some thoughts on the secrets of Sinatra's enduring appeal. Wilfred Sheed, tell us what it is about Frank Sinatra that keeps us focused on him even at this juncture.
Well, I think the quality of the songs themselves, you know you're never going to hear them sung better than this. I think the thing you have to remember about Sinatra, we were all listening to the radio from morning to night in those days, and we were getting better and better at it, expecting more. And this was the best we'd ever heard. I don't think anyone had ever used a microphone as well as he had. Nobody worked with big bands better than he did. You know, whatever it was, he was the best.
And what qualities of language and music make those songs so enduring to this day?
Well, I there are two schools of thought about this. There are some people who think the lyrics were the strong suit, but I really the tunes were simply incredible, and people who would normally have been writing classical music, all the way to our current Cy Coleman, were simply seduced by the music because the music was doing such interesting things. It was being filled with the improvisation of jazz, was flooding into it. and people like Louis Armstrong were creating music as they played. It was a very, very exciting time.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay.
We also asked Sheet about the contradictions that characterize Sinatra, a sensitive emotional sounding board in performance, but offstage often a rude, crude, macho manipulator with legendary ties to the underworld that dominated the saloons he first played in and always enjoyed.
If you see a film of him making a record, you realize this is an incredibly serious man in this one respect. He's almost reverent about music, and when he names the musicians he's playing with or he names the songwriters, it's with enormous respect. So, and you wouldn't even guess the other side of him. After Hours, he likes to play around. He's, in fact, I gather, hasn't changed that much. He was always a wise guy from Hoboken.
Take me back, I love you. Pity me.
For a singer's take on what made him so special, we turn to cabaret star Andrea Markovici, also an actor like Sinatra.
I think it started so long ago. What made him so special was that he was willing to be a male torch singer. That's what I think. I think that he was willing to show heartbreak from the male point of view. That's when it really started, the extraordinary quality of Frank Sinatra. He would just bleed over lost love, and this wasn't something I think very typical in the male singers. It was something very expected in the female singers.
What do you think makes this music so enduring? Is it the sentiment? Is it the use of language? Is it pre-Sondheim that you can actually remember and hum?
I think it's a combination of the fact that the melodies are memorable, and that they're really ambitious, therefore they're something to really grab onto. But I think it is essentially the use of language, and that we've missed lately this sophisticated style of language, the wit, the intelligence, and the poetry.
I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn, and a king.
Finally, when an old Sinatra concert with Rat Pack pals Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. was broadcast on cable, we asked daughter Tina Sinatra about the old man's appeal.
Forget the talent. That's a given. That's a God-given thing. He recognized it. He nurtured it, and he sustained. He's had a long, good life. But I think attitude had a lot to do with it. I think that if Dad had lived a life more like, say, Perry Como, who was, you know, long married and a golfing, relaxed guy. You know, Dad was a little more of a, as Bing Crosby referred to him once, he said, I was sort of the pup under the porch and Frank was out chasing the cars or something like that. He just had that magnetism and energy that he had to bend it, you know, and fortunately for all of us, he did it on a stage. And I think it was his persona. I mean, he was a unique, I'll do it my way kind of guy. You should pardon the horrible pun.
And more, much more than this, I did it my way.
Remembering Frank Sinatra with daughter Tina, Wilfred Sheet, and Andrea Markovici. From our May 17, 1998 Newsweek On Air show, Tina Sinatra published My Father's Daughter, a memoir in 2000. In 2008, my friend Sheed won an ASCAP Deems Taylor Book Award for The House That George Built, Gershwin, of course, with a little help from Irving, Berlin that is, Cole, that would be Porter, and a crew of about 50. He died in 2011. Markovici, the most frequent entertainment guest on our show over the years, still sings around the world and will co-host one of four nights of the 25th Annual Cabaret Convention, October 20 through 23, in the Rose Theater, Jazz at Lincoln Center on Broadway in Manhattan. Next, Shame and Fame, Faith and Fashion, for your ears only. Some final steps down memory lane for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern, but first another quote from last week's news. I know it's just a business now. That was disillusioned football fan Nicole Laverick of Chicago after disappointing NFL and team reaction to the latest domestic abuse cases, including that of Minnesota Vikings Adrian Peterson involving his 4-year-old son and Jonathan Dwyer of the Arizona Cardinals involving an 18-month-old and its mother. With fans and sponsors backing away, NFL boss Roger Goodell refused to resign but pledged a better policy next year. Now, another aspect of abuse from our February 29, 2004 Newsweek On Air broadcast with co-host Sandy Kozel of AP.
The heartfelt sorrow that we feel for this violation and the often ineffective ways with which it was dealt has strengthened our commitment to do everything possible to see that it does not happen again.
That's Bishop Wilton Gregory, president of the U.S. Conference of Bishops, responding to the National Review Board's long-awaited review of the priest abuse crisis in the Roman Catholic Church. The stunning results from a pair of studies found more than 10,000 reported cases of alleged abuse, incidents which rose slowly in the 1950s, climbed quickly in the next decade, and peaked between 1970 and 80 when 800 alleged abuse incidents happened each year.
Among the findings of the study compiled by the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, 81% of the alleged sexual abuse victims were male, and of all priests against whom allegations were made, only 2% received prison sentences. The Catholic Church so far has paid out more than $657 million for legal expenses and treatment of priests. The report places heavy blame on bishops, saying they failed to report abuse to police, allowed suspected abusers to stay in parishes, and spent $572 million on legal settlements and counseling.
Joining us for reaction is James Post, president of the Voice of the Faithful, which describes itself as a worldwide movement of mainstream Catholics formed in response to the clergy sexual abuse crisis. Mr. Post, how accurate do you think the study's count of alleged abuse cases is?
Well, I think probably the study is underreporting both the numbers of victims and possibly the number of priests. I think but the estimates on priests are twice what we've been led to believe before. So I think the overall picture is one of a magnitude of a tragedy that is just enormous and absolutely requires fundamental change.
And what about the absence of accountability for the role Catholic bishops may have played in all this?
The absence of accountability is a central omission in this report. I think there's no question that the questions that reasonable people have are, what did they know, when did they know it, and what did they do about it? And we have no answers to those questions.
You've even created an online petition now calling for bishop accountability. What are you asking people to sign on to?
There are three petitions that need to be, we're asking people to sign. One, to ask the Vatican to remove bishops who knowingly transferred abusive priests. We're calling on bishops to cooperate with public authorities in the investigation, and we're calling on bishops to resign voluntarily if they have been complicit in the movement of predators.
Bishop Gregory saw as a positive sign the drop-off in abuse cases reported as the years have gone by. Do you see that as an improvement in the situation, that the church has turned the corner?
We certainly hope that that's the case, but I think we also have to look at the data that they presented that shows that the number of victims who have come forward has exploded in the last 2 years. So I think the jury is out in terms of the direction of this trend. My suspicion is that we're going to see many more victims come forward.
Of course, the bishops created the National Review Board, which has overseen these studies and called for them, which came out last week. But how much credit goes to lay people and groups such as yours who've been pushing for an accounting?
It was the lay review board, the National Review Board, all composed of lay people that worked so hard to make this happen. Laity really has to be up and out of their chairs, and they have to be calling for change. This report speaks to the past, but it also speaks to the future for the Catholic Church. That future depends on an active laity demanding change, real deep cultural change in the church.
And going back to the initial problem, what kind of changes in the selection of candidates for the priesthood or their training would you like to see to make sure the men with abusive tendencies do not become priests?
Certainly the kind of testing that needs to be done has to be much more rigorous. We also think that there ought to be more lay involvement in the review of candidates as they move through the seminaries. After all, they are going to be ministering to a population of laity. I think the laity has a big, big stake in knowing that they have qualified seminarians and qualified priests.
J. James Post is president of the Catholic lay group, The Voice of the Faithful.
From our February 29, 2004 Newsweek On Air broadcast, repeated in our Best of 2004 show, along with an October 3rd tribute to fashion and celebrity photographer Richard Avedon, who died days later. Specifically, his response on our September 5th, 1993 show to charges he exploited every surface flaw of his subjects.
Of course. So there are two things there. One is the question of cruelty, which is absurd in the matter of art. You would never say that about Goya's portraits or horrors of war. You would never say it about Francis Bacon. There's no cruelty involved with showing what I see and, more importantly, what I feel. I photograph as a painter would paint, as a way of expressing my life view. When I see a retouched face or a so-called a good angle, someone's good angle, very often you get that with celebrities who have a sense of what they look like, I see something usually quite false and unnatural and unfamiliar to me. When I walk down the street, when I meet someone for the first time, I have an immediate impression. And it doesn't have to do with glorious lighting and a cosmetic version of what the world is supposed to be. I'm as much, I would think, any good photographer is as much an artist as a man with a brush or a writer is works with a typewriter or is by pencil.
Avedon on our September 5th, 1993 show. He also noted long before he was the model for a photographer played by singer-dancer Fred Astaire in the film Funny Face, Avedon had based his own suave style on the earlier films of Astaire.
I love your funny face. Your sunny, funny face.
Astaire in Funny Face. And this has been For Your Ears Only. For this final month, For Your Ears Only On Air is also online at iTunes, YouTube, FeedBurner.com, and going back years now at archive.org/details/For Your Ears Only. This encore broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studio, Play It Productions. I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the GateWave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Contact me at davidearsonly@gmail.com. Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago. But in this final month, we're digging deeper into our 32-plus years of past programs while looking for resonance with today's big news. So as the nation starts down the road to war once more, here's an expert's view on the most successful U.S. military operation in real life, R-E-A-L, and real life, R-E-E-L, from our July 5, 1998 Newsweek On Air show with co-host Warren Levinson of AP and me.
The last great invasion.
I'll see you on the beach.
Of the last great war. The greatest danger for eight men.
Some private lost three of his brothers and he's got a ticket home.
Was saving one.
It's not going to be easy to find one particular soldier in the whole damn war.
That's my mission.
The low-key trailer for Saving Private Ryan will not prepare anyone for the first 20 minutes of the latest Steven Spielberg extravaganza. Tom Hanks leads his squad onto Omaha Beach in the Normandy invasion that turned the tide of the Second World War. Their mission is a mixture of humanitarianism and image control, saving the last remaining son of a family that's already lost three. And they go through a hell never so bloodily depicted on screen. Bullets exploding, GI skulls, legs blown away, bowels oozing out of shrapnel wounds. Scenes that Spielberg discovered had been censored from a real documentary of the invasion by director John Huston in 1944.
Hanks and his fellow actors went through a rigorous 10-day boot camp under a former Marine captain, hauling 40 pounds of equipment on 5-mile marches through muddy fields on 3 hours sleep. But with little explanation of the war's larger aims or importance, the film may seem to some simply the most graphic anti-war film ever made in the aftermath of Vietnam.
For more on D-Day, the war, and Saving Private Ryan, we're pleased to have Stephen Ambrose, historical consultant for the film, now collaborating about it on a book with Spielberg. Stephen Ambrose, you write that Spielberg is the first filmmaker to capture the cataclysm of the Normandy invasion so exactly. Remind us what kind of opposition those men were facing.
Well, they faced the most difficult defensive works ever built, the Atlantic Wall, manned by German troops with machine guns and mortars, rifles. The works, 88s, all of them pre-sighted, crisscrossing fire across the beach. And in the first wave came in, it was Company A of the 119th Regiment of the 29th Infantry Division, and those ramps went down on those Higgins boats. The German fire into those boats was such that nobody got off of them. Company A did not make it to the beach. It just took heart-stopping losses, 95%. Now, more landing craft were coming in, and the Germans couldn't concentrate their fire as much, and their weapons eventually start to heat up, and they begin eventually to run low on ammunition, and finally they got in, but the price that was paid was 2,000 lives.
And what kind of attitude did these guys come in with? I mean, was this a gung-ho attitude?
They came with the attitude, this is a job that's got to be done. The only way we're going to be able to go home is to get to Berlin first. And they knew that, and there wasn't any question about it. So it had to be done.
And what was the context in which they were fighting?
Well, first of all, they were fighting beside men that they had gone off to boot camp with, had gone through training with, had hated this same drill sergeant together with, the guy that they had first gotten drunk in their lives with, the guys they'd shipped over with, the guys they'd done all their training with. And that's the number one motivation. You don't want to look the coward in front of your buddies. You don't want to ever let your buddies down. That's the unpardonable sin in combat. It's what makes a man stay and face the fire when every instinct in his body tells him, get out of here. And then there is the other. As one veteran, I always ask at the end of interviews, well, what does it all mean? Sometimes I get, geez, that's too big a question, and sometimes I get a thoughtful answer. And one guy said to me, listen, Steve, I was 18 years old. I had my life ahead of me. I knew the difference between right and wrong, and I didn't want to live in a world in which wrong prevailed. So I fought.
There are those who say that throwing in a kind of cynicism or throwing in a kind of, we got to get the job done because that's the only way we get to go home, into a World War II movie, in a sense, takes away the context of World War II, takes away the notion that these guys were fighting for nothing less than to save civilization.
Of course they were fighting to save civilization, and of course they never talked about that. I mean, this isn't the Civil War when men used words like duty, honor, country. And the World War I had happened. You couldn't talk that way about war after World War I. But they felt it. They felt it very deeply. These were the children of democracy. And they knew democracy was at stake. And they also knew very cold-bloodedly, and the only way home is to go east. We got to beat the Nazis first. And they knew their price was going to be paid, but of course they were 18 years old. Now, one captain briefed his company. He said, just before going in on D-Day, he said, 8 or 9 of you guys out of every 10 is going to be dead or wounded tonight. And the guy who told me the story said, Steve, I looked to my left and I looked to my right and I thought to myself, you poor bastards.
There are those who have seen Private Ryan who say there isn't enough history or that kind of context to explain why so many people thought the sacrifice was necessary. Do you think younger audiences could come away thinking that war was a waste? And if World War II was a waste, is any war worth fighting?
I don't know how that's going to work out. I've had a bit of that concern myself, but I remind myself that this is Steven Spielberg. He made Schindler's List. He doesn't have to tell us what this war was about. It's not easy to say that Western civilization was at stake, but it was. I can understand the critics, though, saying somewhere in there Spielberg should have done something to remind people of what this war was all about. I myself would go with the choice he made that by this time people certainly know that.
Besides Private Ryan, there are more than half a dozen World War II films in the works. Your books, D-Day and Citizen Soldiers, have sold nearly 1 million copies. Why do you think this appetite has welled up so strongly now?
Because we are yearning for a hero, and we don't have any around in the contemporary scene. So we reach back in time to heroes, and we certainly got them. Dwight Eisenhower is a starter, George Marshall, Franklin Roosevelt. But then it gets down to these NCOs and junior officers and these guys just out of college to whom fell a responsibility that they seized. And that's heroic. And the responsibilities these guys assumed. I mean, I know guys who at age 18 were commanding rifle platoons in action. Guys at age 19 commanding a rifle company. That's 200 men. And I'm not talking about the duration of a football game here, or a day or a week. I'm talking months. I know guys who at age 20 took LSTs across the ocean, a crew of 48, and landed them at Omaha Beach. And these guys are heroes, and they're the most ordinary of guys.
World War II historian Stephen Ambrose was a consultant to Steven Spielberg for the movie Saving Private Ryan.
The Reality of Ryan, from our July 5th, 1998 Newsweek On Air program. Tom Hanks closely studied the Ambrose World War II book Band of Brothers for Saving Private Ryan, and it became the basis of an eponymous HBO miniseries in 2001. Ambrose also wrote biographies of Presidents Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, and about bravery in an earlier era, undaunted courage, Meriwether Lewis, Thomas Jefferson, and the opening of the American West. He died in 2002. I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now Andrea Markovici again with two songs that helped get the Allies through World War II. From her I'll Be Seeing You CD that she'll perform live next month at the Raz Room in New Hope, Pennsylvania, and in November at Merkin Concert Hall in New York.
When night shadows fall, I still can recall out there across the sea. Twilight streaming down on a little town, it's fresh in my memory. I hear a mother pray and to her baby say, don't cry, this is her lullaby. There'll be the white cliffs of Dover tomorrow, just you wait and see. There'll be love and laughter and peace ever after tomorrow, when the world is free. The shepherd will tend his sheep, the valley will bloom again, and Jimmy will go to sleep in his own little room again. There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover tomorrow, just you wait and see. When the lights go